Well, welcome back to Fear or Favour. Nizir, how's your week been? I ask you that every week. Tell me something different.
No, I can't. It's still been busy, but actually this week's been quite interesting because I've been working with people like Gary Neville and Jason Manford and others who've been supporting a campaign that we've been running to get the Parliament to agree that misogyny should be a hate crime. And so the House of Lords recommended and approved the amendment. It now goes to the House of Commons, and it's a great, you know, it's a great tribute to these people, particularly these men who are high profile men, to say, look, we must challenge misogyny. That's ultimately how we'll protect women. And I think, you know, it's been very successful in that regard up to now. But, you know, the House of Commons is a different kettle of fish, I'm afraid.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't know Gary Neville, but Jason Manford, I know, and he's a really top guy.
He's absolutely
genuine bloke. And I've got a lot of time for Jason. He's a nice guy. So there's been a busy week, hasn't it? I mean, I think in terms of the things that you're currently doing, I mean, that misogyny is always something that we keep fighting. And of course, there's been a very high profile murder in Ireland in the past week. Yeah. And there is now a process through the criminal justice system where an individual has been charged. But it has resonated again because, of course, it's brought back the whole scenarios that we've had with Sarah Everard in the UK.
Absolutely. I mean, the Irish have understood that they have similar. I mean, not just the Irish, the whole world has the same issue. But there's obviously some real close working going on between organizations like Irish Women's Aid and the English Women's Aid in England and Wales. And so, you know, it resonates. The fact that this particular individual, Aisling, was going for a run and allegedly targeted in that capacity, whereas, you know, Sarah Everard was simply going home. You know, so the fact that too often we blame victims when in fact we should be blaming the perpetrators, and that resonates everywhere.
Women have to feel safe. You know, if you've got a young woman walking down or jogging down the footpath and you've got another woman just walking home at night, you know, they should absolutely feel safe. And the reality is, sadly, they don't.
No, they don't. And I think there've been lots of vigils. It's an open sore that needs to be addressed. And my personal view is that Parliament has a role to play here in setting out some leadership in this area, and rather than simply saying, as they have done too often, oh, we need better street lighting, or we need more alarms and rape alarms. Actually, that only just deals with the symptom, rather than the cause.
Absolutely. Well, Nizir, you always talk sense. And I think getting behind that campaign with the likes of Jason Manford and Gary Neville is fantastic to get those high profile people on board. And hopefully the people in government will listen and start to act upon it. I've had a busy week. I'm still working on my new Princess Diana documentary, which is fascinating. And I'm about to launch next week my podcast, The Detective, which has got its latest investigation, which is the unsolved murder of Lee Boxall. We've teamed up with The Mirror and Crime Stoppers, who are going to make an announcement in terms of a new appeal from them. So that's very exciting. And we are going to, for the very first time, name who we believe killed Lee Boxall and the circumstances. So a pretty big announcement next week.
Well done.
And this week, of course, another programme, Maxwell and Prince Andrew. I watched it. It's always a very difficult one because after every single programme, of course, the next programme wants to try and find new information that the previous ones haven't. You know, it's about headline grabbing. And I think the headline grabbing for this was the phone call that Ranveer Singh made to a telephone number, which was believed to be Prince Andrew. It didn't reveal much else in the programme. But I tell you what I find fascinating, and I've now managed to get hold of that Maxwell unredacted address book and also the manifest. And the thing that stands out for me is we all know about Prince Andrew's story now, and that's going to be heard through court. Mm-hmm. But what about these other high-profile individuals? You know, the likes of Clinton, the likes of Trump, and many others who appear in those books and having gone on the Lolita Express in the manifest. We need to go after
allegedly.
Those people.
Allegedly.
Yes. Well, I mean, they are in the book, and they are
in the book. It's written on the Leisure Express.
And there's a reference in terms of the names. So you've got an initials, and some of them have admitted to doing that. Of course, going on the Lolita Express doesn't mean that you've committed any offences. No. It just means you've been on an aeroplane.
Yeah. Well, I think we've discussed before, the Americans are much more, have less deference to power and wealth. And so that's the reason why so many prosecutions and so many civil actions take place in the United States, because they tend to not care about whether somebody's powerful or not. But the question has to be asked. We're still waiting, obviously, for Ghislaine Maxwell's sentencing or potentially any other legal arguments there. But there will be more that will come out, I have no doubt. And we'll have to play the long game. I think the general public want everybody that's involved in this to be brought to justice for what they've done, regardless of who they are. And we'll have to, literally all we can do, Mark, is wait and see.
Absolutely. Well, we will continue to cover it. It's become something that certainly our listeners are fascinated in, and like you and I are as well. So we're mixing it up a bit this week. We've got a guest, actually our first guest on the show, Charlotte Rolls. So Charlotte's a TV producer, undercover investigations for BBC Panorama, the flagship current affairs programme. She's filmed in jail, death rows, and also worked reviewing miscarriages of justice. Charlotte, thank you so much for joining us. How are you?
I'm really well. Thank you very much for having us. I'm very honoured to be the first guest.
No, the honour is only ours, okay? When you contacted me, and this is one of the things we encourage people to do, is to not only give us feedback on the podcast, but to bring things to our attention, and what you brought to our attention really needs to be shared with everybody.
Yeah, I was really thrilled, I have to say, to get your email, because I am aware, and like a lot of people, I suppose, came maybe a bit late to the game and kind of was aware of you from Desert Island Discs, and really struck by sort of your personal take on justice. And I think probably I feel like I have that too. You know, I've often followed up cases that I've maybe reported on for Panorama and kind of then continued to write about them, probably at sometimes detriment to my career prospects, etc. Mm-hmm. But certainly the Stephen Port case, the one that we are maybe going to cover today, was something that I was really sort of personally interested in covering. And as you might well be aware, I mean, the background to the case is that Stephen Port was a serial killer who killed four young gay men between 2014 and 2015. And I think one of the absolutely crucial lines for me was after the inquest, which has recently concluded, basically said Stephen Port was no criminal mastermind, but police failings made him a serial killer, allowed him to be a serial killer. That was absolutely key for me.
No,
100%. Charlotte, I mean, I think one of the things that's fascinating, you started to set the scene, which is fantastic. Stephen Port, convicted serial killer, he used dating apps as well as social networks in order to contact his many victims, four murders, at least 11 more other victims. He created false legends, and by that I mean backgrounds, his jobs, his lifestyle. He used the commonly known GHB date rape drug, as well as Viagra, crystal meth, in order to ply his victims so that they were in a position that they couldn't respond. But what is shocking about this, and let's go right back to the very first murder, Anthony Walker, 23 years old, a fashion student, and he was an occasional escort. Now, he met Port in June 2014. The background to this is that as a result of killing him, Port then places him in a cemetery to be found, but not just once, with future victims. But let's just talk about, in relation to Anthony, how come the police didn't dig further and find out there's more to this?
Okay, so just to go back ever so slightly, so obviously you've stated clearly that there were a number of other convictions brought together, a number of rape cases prior to this one, but obviously in terms of murder convictions, that Anthony Walgate was the first known victim. And what seemed to have happened, and certainly kind of came out of the inquest, was that, as you pointed out, Anthony was a fashion student, but he occasionally worked as an escort, and Port was able to contact him through gay dating apps. And how it all turned out was that Port had very oddly decided he would make a 999 phone call, pretending that he was completely unconnected with the case, when actually, of course, it turned out ultimately that he was the person responsible for giving Anthony this GBH, the date rape drug. And he placed him outside his property on Cook Street in Barking in East London, and then tried to pass it off as having nothing to do with him. When subsequently it was looked at slightly further by the borough CID at Barking and Dagenham, it became clear that this was slightly more complicated, and Paul ultimately pleaded guilty to lying. But what he maintained was that Anthony had taken this drug himself, and Paul had come back and found him unconscious and then panicked and left him outside his flat. Yeah. Of course, that all sort of subsequently came out. But the crucial thing I think to remember here is that at each stage, these deaths were assumed by CID to not be suspicious, and they didn't necessarily have the resources. I mean, so I sat through a number of days of evidence, and as you could imagine, there's huge detail there. So 4 death investigations, I think there was maybe 800 plus documents that kind of came to bear and came out on the case. And there was obviously the police complaints that they had various documentation from them as well. But I think it's worth noting that from the police complaints, there were 17 officers from the borough CID, also right up to homicide squad at the Met. And they were pulled in for questioning, and only one of them actually did any questions. Rather, all the rest of them did no comment interview. So I suppose that's one thing maybe to look at. Mm-hmm. But also to say that in terms of understanding how that all played out, that I think I certainly kind of heard the officer in charge of the first case, the Anthony Woolgate case, and he was saying that he was acting up and that he did not have the necessary training, which, Mark, you might well be more aware of. You know, I think the common parlance is PIP level 3 training in order to investigate a murder. So none of the officers dealing with it at the early stages seem to have that. But what struck me, having sort of listened in an overview, you know, if you took the 4 victims, the spectacular fails that were there were so staggering that you could just hear a pin drop in the press room where I was sitting and listening to all of this. So for the first victim, the police didn't check his phone or computer. So, you know, that's sort of one thing, really. Then if you move on to the second victim, Gabriel Cavari, because the police had decided that they weren't going to warn or engage the gay community, that there were a number of murders happening where it appeared that gay men were being targeted, there was no one that came forward, but actually Port's neighbour was aware that Port was a landlord for Gabriel Cavari, and then made up some ridiculous story that, don't tell anybody, but Gabriel died from this mysterious illness. He had real concerns about that. But as I say, because the police had not put any information out about that, then there was that issue dropped off the radar. You move on sometime later to the third victim, Daniel Whitworth. And I mean, this is absolutely staggering to me, having an interest in forensic science and criminal and investigations in miscarriage of justice cases, because Daniel's body was found with a bedsheet wrapped around the body in a churchyard in Barking, and the police, despite very clear urging from the pathologist who did the special post mortem, did not test this for DNA. And of course, I mean, the family were absolutely staggered to find out when it came to the first inquest that was the case, that there was even a bedsheet. They didn't know it. So had they have tested that bedsheet, they would have found Port's DNA on it, because they had it from the first case when they had arrested him for perverting the course of justice.
Shocking. You move on. Let's hold that minute, because Nazir, we've talked about vulnerability of certain types and classes and individuals. And here we have the gay community who are vulnerable.
Absolutely. Homophobia and homophobic hate crime is something that we've been very much aware of for several decades now. And obviously there's legislation against it more recently in the last 20 years. When I'm listening to Charlotte, I'm thinking, oh my God, why? You know, why, where was the professional curiosity? You know, why weren't questions being asked? Where was the supervision? You know, allowing, yes, let's assume for a moment that these officers say that they weren't experienced enough or trained well enough. But, you know, there should be supervisors in place to make sure that they ask the right questions and ensure that you know, work that should be done is done. And, you know, what then plays into that, Mark, Charlotte, is this perception that somehow there's institutional homophobia here, that actually because they are gay, the police didn't take it very seriously. And it reminds me, not similar, but I dealt with Colin Ireland in the mid-early 90s, and he killed five gay men in London. And again, there was I think it was only about until the third one before the police said, we might have a serial killer on our hands. And rather than, you know, after one, thinking, yeah, I'm then seeing a second with similar MO is the phrase, isn't it? You think, hang on a minute, there's something amiss here. And so after 20-odd years, you think they might have learned some lessons. Mm. What I think Charlotte is painting is a picture of an institution that hasn't learned lessons, that simply treats crimes against gay people in the way they shouldn't be treated, i.e. not taken very seriously, and allow very junior officers to make decisions on it rather than as it should happen. And you will know from your experience, Mark, you know, homicide teams with very experienced officers should have taken control.
Yeah, and there are elements of society who are more vulnerable than others. You know, the elderly, children, homosexuals, prostitutes, you know, working girls, those are more vulnerable in society. And let's go back to the 70s and 80s. You know, I've just done a big investigation program in relation to the Yorkshire Ripper, where misogyny was a massive issue, where it was working girls were, you know, they were less worthy than others. And in fact, it wasn't until a murder took place of a girl who wasn't a working girl that actually the press got behind it and now started to say, you know, these are innocent girls being murdered. And let's fast forward. A escort, a homosexual, ends up being murdered, and we're in a position, potentially, and I'm not saying this is a case, but it does raise that very clear question. Were they not dealt with as others would have been dealt with by simply because of who they were and because of their lifestyle and because of their background? And
well, that's exactly what Charlotte, I believe, and I'm sure Charlotte believes too, that, you know, I'm not going to put words in your mouth, Charlotte, but, you know, when reading about this case and when trying to understand this case, you know, potentially, this is the $64 billion question. If they had understood that Stephen Port was responsible for the first murder, three other men would still be alive. That is the question, really, that I'm asking.
I mean, yeah, because you would absolutely say that, wouldn't you? Very often, I think that you deal in those hypotheticals, but then you just, with this case, it felt so absolutely clear that the consequences of not joining the dots, of being curious, of pushing through on kind of doing those tests, on treating the victim's family, who obviously have a role to play in this, of what they were saying is important. It felt like this is just such a clear cut example of where victims' families were absolutely ruled out. You know, people were saying to me, gosh, it's as if the victims' families are the detectives in the case. It was absolute turnaround. Can I just go back to one point as well? You were saying about the Colin Ireland case. It was interesting you bring that up because that came up as a point in the inquest, because there was a very high level police district assistant commissioner there who would, you know, had come to apologise to the family. But I think very shortly after he made his sort of fairly fulsome apology, the issue about the Met really having kind of a history on this came through, because the Met's own advisory committee on LGBTQ subjects, or, you know, the whole area, they had done a report which was published in 2007 about the Colin Ireland case. And they specifically said the failure to warn and engage with the community, the gay community on this one specifically, was represented as serious failure in policing.
And why did that happen, Charlotte? Why again are we in a position after Ireland and after all the other inquiries that have come out in relation to murders, but particularly Ireland, because it related to a homosexual serial killer? Why were the community not made aware? What was the Metropolitan's response to that?
It felt like there was a very much a sort of vague response to that. But I mean, the irony is underlined by the fact that eventually, maybe I'm not completely sure when, but at a point where there had been a number of murders, there was some outreach by the local police to involve the community. And there was a representative from the homeless community there, invited by the police, on the basis of the fact that the two bodies that were found in St. Margaret's Churchyard was a known place for homeless people to be. Well, you would have to say, why on earth is that the case when you've got a number of victims and their commonality is their sexuality?
I know.
You know, that was absolutely and utterly there. So,
and how many previous deaths had there been in that cemetery prior to that? I mean, was this a regular occurrence of homeless homosexuals turning up dead in that cemetery?
Actually, I think that that was a question that was put, but I think maybe the angle was slightly more from the point of view of examining how experienced the officers that were dealing with these cases were. So I don't think that that was a particular issue necessarily that kind of had come out, but it was more, as I say, exposing.
But it's a central issue for me as an investigator. I'd be asking the question, so let's look at this. How many people have turned up in this graveyard as homeless, homosexuals, dead, yet we've suddenly got two in a very close proximity to each other? You know, that would start to raise real alarm bells with me. And particularly when you then got the third one, I'd start going, hang on a minute, who lives close to this? You know, from a geographical profiling point of view, you'd start to think there must be something connecting these deaths together.
Yes. Well, I mean, that's, I think, kind of like everyone that sat in the inquest hearing the evidence was thinking that all the way through. It just sort of seemed absolutely staggering that that wasn't being done. I mean, to the extent that with Anthony, the police failed to check Paul's record. So there was an allegation, not a conviction, but an allegation that he had drug raped someone previously. And this was picked up by British Transport Police, but they failed to check the police national computer on that. So
toxicologies were done on all the bodies. And did the toxicologies on Anthony show that he had GHB and mess or whatever else in his body?
So eventually toxicology results come back, and this maybe feeds into sort of something that I've been looking at as well, because there is an issue about kind of potential rationing and whether police forces are only allowed to get toxicology results on a sort of certain basis. But it seemed to have took an inordinate amount of time for that to come back. Once that did come back, the officer in charge of the case then sought the involvement of the homicide squad, saying that this was a very complicated case and that he didn't think the detectives that were working on it currently had the relevant experience to take that on. But that was pushed back, and I have to say pushed back quite considerably. There's been a BBC drama that's gone on just over the last week or so on this case called Four Lives, and it looks at the perspective of the families and their battle for justice, really. But one of the things that I felt it glossed over slightly, I mean, obviously someone in my position is always wanting to understand a bit more about the police, but that it was very much a case that the police from the homicide serious crime element from the Met were painted as the sort of rescuers of the thing. But actually from a very early stage, Barkingham Dagenham Police were asking them to take the case over and bring their considerable resources to bear. And there was pushback on that, and that didn't happen.
I think, Nazir, we've talked about this before, but the whole submission of evidence, given the huge costs involved now, you know, we don't have our own forensic science service, everything's outsourced. So there's a cost implication to every single item that's sent off for analysis. And of course, the officer has to make a decision. Do I send those toxicology tests off? Do I send those other items off to be examined? And I'm only going to do that if I think that there's potentially a suspicion here rather than a natural death. That's a big impact, isn't it, now on police?
I think it clearly has an impact. In this particular case, I'm not entirely sure. Yeah, I mean, it should have happened. I don't think the resources were, in terms of seeking forensic, the issue. I think it was simply the fact they just didn't want to do it. I think what Charlotte is painting is a picture of an institution that's somewhat broken, whether it's because of homophobia or whether it's because of race or whether it's because of gender or sex, whatever it may be, that they just did not want to join the dots. Because looking back now, everybody uses the word hindsight as if, you know, that means that, you know, you're being better than us. No, actually, we didn't need hindsight at the time. somebody who should have been curious, or could have been curious, should have asked the question. And I think, you know, it's not just a Met issue, because obviously in Greater Manchester a couple of years ago, we had the conviction of Reynard Singer. You may recall he was convicted of the rapes of 49 men over several years. And when the inquiry followed, the potentially over 206, I think, 206 men were identified as being his victims, with a similar, you know, the use of drugs, etc. Many of the men did not know they'd been raped until, well, until they were approached by the police, because he, you know, Singer had recorded or kept items back. So if it's just, you know, so it's not just the Met police.
No,
you know,
there are
questions that need to be asked of policing generally. And, you know, the question they have to ask is, what role did the did homophobia play? What role did their view about gay people and gay men in particular play here? And, you know, the question, I've asked it and I'll answer it. It played a big role here. Can you imagine for a moment that the first victim was a young woman who'd been for a run, for example? We talked about it right at the outset. I think in the current climate, there is no way on earth that the police would not treat that as a more than suspicious death.
Yeah.
You know, Charlotte made the point. He made a phone call from his own phone, if I remember rightly. Mm. Nobody looked at his phone. Nobody looked at his laptop. And these are simple questions that could have been asked, simple inquiries that should have been done and would be routinely done, potentially, in any other suspicious death, which weren't here. And there can really only be one answer, Mark, and that is that homophobia played a part here.
Yeah, I think I don't think it can't possibly be anything other than that. I mean, this is an individual who formed a stereotype from the officers that attended the scene and quite clearly thought, do you know what, this is a man who's a drug user, he's homosexual. And, you know, and I'll go as far as to say, you know, is less worthy than perhaps an investigation we would do on a white middle class lady. And that's a shocking reality of society. I think
policing.
And you're absolutely right. You know, this isn't just to the Met. This is force wide. These are up and down the country. These mistakes are happening. It just happens to be, you know, very much in the spotlight because of the Metropolitan Police is, of course, the largest of all the police forces in the country. But it is an issue that exists.
Can we talk about consequences, Mark? Because I think, Charlotte, I'd like to know your view on this. Because, all right, you've mentioned there were several officers who failed. You know, the inquest and others, other research and your own research has shown that there were several officers that just did not do their job. There is an organization which maybe our listeners haven't heard of yet. That's the Independent Office for Police Conduct, the IOPC, and their job is to investigate complaints against officers in serious matters. The IOPC were engaged here, weren't they?
They were absolutely engaged here. So they did do an investigation, and because there was a slightly complicated route, there were a couple of inquests that were opened and they found open verdicts because they didn't necessarily have all the evidence. And then, of course, subsequently, Port was convicted. So there was a decision to hold all the inquests together. And because of the pandemic, that got kind of held off for quite a period of time. But I was in contact with the IOPC to try and understand what their current take is on it. And as you could imagine, there was a huge amount of pressure on the Met to try and explain what had happened here. So they are in the position they've told me today of considering whether they're going to reopen this. And then I had spoken to the victims' families and they said they're keen for that to happen, but that they lacked maybe faith in whether that was going to find anything out. You know, if you have a system, I suppose, where someone extraordinarily powerful like the police, when you're in a position of being a victim, your loved one's been a victim, it can be the case that you perceive there's serious failings, but actually there's no compulsion for them to necessarily give evidence or to talk. Maybe the faith kind of just falls away from them, you know.
Confidence.
I'm also aware that the victims' families have been invited in to meet the commissioner at the Met, and some of them have followed through on that. But I think, again, they just very much seem to take the view of what's actually going to change, you know, and you have to sort of, that gives you a bit of pause for thought. And also just thinking in terms of the longer term things here, you know, I think that their thing is thinking very much they need to be held to account, you know, and
so
how
no
does
one's
that
been
happen?
Disciplined. No one's been disciplined at all. No internal disciplining.
No,
some of them have been promoted, haven't they?
Well, yes, they have, which, as you could imagine, kind of feels like it really rankles with obviously victims' families. I'm also aware that there's a Twitter campaign that some of them are running at the moment to try and get the officers involved sacked, removed from their jobs.
Has anybody taken responsibility of any of these failings?
I think to each individual officer that I heard give evidence, there was either lines of, I can't recall that, I'm not sure, I don't remember. There was no one really that felt, to my mind, that they sort of put their hands up and said, we got this wrong, I got this wrong. It was very much a case of, we didn't have enough resources in play, et cetera, et cetera. And it feels like it's, you look for someone to be held accountable and you go from one direction to the other.
Shocking. Absolutely shocking. I mean, Nazir, we've talked about this so many times and it's a pet hate of both of ours, is this ability, when you're in an infrastructure, you're an organisation like the police, which closes rank and covers up incompetence, where these individuals should quite clearly be held accountable for their actions, dismissed or certainly disciplined. Absolutely. Yet they're not.
You know, I've said it before, public confidence comes from competence. So when people are incompetent or and demonstrated that they've failed, that damages public confidence. Why would, for example, the LGBT plus community have any faith in policing? You know, why would they go to the police if they feel that they are they're witnesses or even if they're victims when they realize that this is what happens or well what has happened? That's the ultimate consequence of people not having confidence in policing. And that's why that's why the IOPC exists. It's meant to be, to use our podcast name, Acting Without Fear or Favour, to ensure that individuals are disciplined and ultimately, if needs be, they face the consequences of doing so. That when you have a situation where the perception is of cover-up, worse than that, then, as I say, it took campaign by Pink News, it took a campaign by the LGBT plus community, by the families of the deceased, by the families of the rape victims and the rape victims themselves to ultimately deliver justice in this case, when of course that should be the role of police. And it worries me that if people don't take responsibility, all right, now I'm glad the commissioner is inviting them in. I have no doubt, I mean, Charlie, you can answer this question. Is there a civil action being brought by families? Right.
Yes.
Okay. So, you know, lawyers are never, as a lawyer myself, I can assure you, don't act in the best interests of institutions. They act in the best financial interests of an institution. Mm. And I've no doubt the lawyer is probably saying to commissioners and others, do not apologize. Do not admit to everything that went wrong, because ultimately that will hit your bottom line and that, you know, there will be financial consequences here. But they don't think of the bigger picture. The bigger picture, as I just said a moment ago, is having confidence in policing itself. That's what's at stake here. And the first thing I would do is admit that we got things wrong or they got things wrong. And then, number two, what are we going to do to fix it in the future, so that there isn't another Stephen Port, so there aren't other victims of the four that we've mentioned and the ones that were raped. It's a no-brainer.
And that's why, Nazir, you and I are not in that position, because both of us have a strong moral compass and we wouldn't accept that. We'd take the accountability and we take that responsibility. But unfortunately, the likes of individuals within the Metropolitan Police and other police forces haven't got the balls to stand up and say, we got it wrong, accept that, admit it and learn from those differences.
That's why it needs people like Charlotte to, shouldn't have to, but people like Charlotte who become immensely passionate about something, who become really informed about something, who just keep knocking and knocking and knocking, yeah, so that somebody eventually listens. And, you know, it's a credit to you, Charlotte, that you've done that. But it's a shame that the institutions themselves don't fix themselves, because the only way to fix yourself is to accept you've got something wrong. And they refuse to do that.
Yeah, you very much get the feeling on this that everyone was sort of paying a bit of a political lip service to trying to sort of phrase their failures in a way that kind of didn't reflect on people. You know, you'll know yourself that trying to get someone to talk on the record about problems within the police is enormously difficult. But unless you can change that culture where people feel like they're able to come forward and say things, it makes it very difficult.
Yeah. And whistleblowers are always, they always feel that once they blow, that that's the end of their careers.
Yeah. And for many it is. And for many it is.
Yeah. Charlotte, you were saying?
I wondered if I could kind of just pull in a couple of points, you know, just in terms of the forensic evidence here and the role that that sort of potentially played. I, as you could imagine, have sort of sought the advice on a number of colleagues who are more experienced than me in terms of trying to understand why some of the forensic tests weren't done. And as I understand it, there has very much been that shift towards privatisation, and now the police are more maybe in control of making some of those decisions. So the decision as to whether to examine the laptop, whether to examine the phone, the digital forensics, which are absolutely key in this case, was much more something that the police had control over. And the pushback from the officers seemed to be that there wasn't the money in the budgets to do that. I mean, so that's one thing, I suppose, to kind of take into account to try and understand how this came to pass, and is obviously a serious worry. You know, I've spoken to colleagues who I've worked with who are experts in forensics, and they say this line to me, that were the Stephen Lawrence case to happen again, the tests that were necessary to try and look at the evidence might well not even be commissioned. They might not be requested by the police because the police don't have that high level of understanding as to what is necessary to look at. And you're aware, obviously, that how that played out with Stephen Lawrence was an extraordinarily lengthy search to try and kind of get enough evidence to get the killers on that. But eventually, forensic evidence did come forward. Now, if we're in the situation where, on an ongoing basis, those tests are being decided upon by the police, and in this case, they very clearly, despite absolute categorical evidence from pathologists who've had years of experience, did not do those tests. Well, Port can, and people like him, can slip under the radar. Yeah, and that's a real worry for the justice system in the future.
Charlotte, I just want to look at the inquest and in terms of some of the decision-making process. Let's look in terms of the evidence. And at what point did the police decide that these four murders were committed by the same person?
Okay, so by the time that the fourth victim was killed, Jack Taylor, there was quite heavy involvement, I think fair to say, from his family. They pushed to get hold of CCTV, and that CCTV was picked up and showing Jack meeting Stephen Port at Barking train station. And it was then, I don't know, being made available or being viewed within the police station at Barking and Dagenham. And the officer that was in charge of the Anthony Walgate case, the first victim, recognised Port. And at that point, well, they described it in the inquest as a goosebump moment.
So that was the moment it changed. And so if the family had not been persistent in relation to the murder of Jack Taylor, it may not have moved further forward. It may well have been unsolved murders. Or they weren't even murders. They weren't classified as murders. I suppose that's a point. They weren't. They were classified as deaths.
Absolutely. So, I mean, that felt very much to me like the kind of key turning point. But it's worth saying, I think, that even at that stage where, as you could imagine, just the links were maybe coming into place, the missed evidence, the opportunities, et cetera, you know, I mean, Gabriel Cavara's flatmate was saying, why didn't the police listen to me when I told them that I had suspected who was involved with this? He was in contact with Port using a pseudonym to try and understand what was happening. But yes, had that police officer not been present and said, I recognise this man on the CCTV, you wonder. But at that stage, it was a decision that homicide must get involved, and Port was arrested, I think, within a day or so.
And all the inquest outcome is an open verdict. Does that still stand, or have the inquests been...
Sorry, it is complicated, just to be completely clear. So what had happened, I think maybe 10 or so months after Anthony Walgate's death, is that there was an inquest held, and there was partial evidence, and it felt very much like the coroner was doing the job of the police in asking okay, so you have port the suspect's laptop. Was that examined? The answer came back from the police. No, it wasn't examined. So it was sent off for examination. And then the officer in charge, who didn't have experience in forensics, only found partial information. So there was, I think that on behalf of the establishment, maybe it was felt that there was real lack of conclusion about what the open verdict left for the family. And then subsequently, obviously, Port became identified and then was successfully convicted of the Old Bailey in 2016 and given a whole life tariff.
Have those open verdict inquests been quashed?
As I understand it, they have been overturned. And then the most recent inquest was a joint inquest for all four men because there were such commonalities and obviously a common killer. And the verdict that came back on the three men, not Anthony Woolgate, the verdict that came back on the three men was saying that probably the Met failings contributed to their deaths.
Yeah, yeah, but has that inquest come back unlawful killing?
Yeah, in relation to this?
Unlawful killing, yes, I'm sorry, it has, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that came in December 2021, but yeah, a huge amount of time waiting for the family and agonising over this, I think.
I mean, Nazir, again, down to the family to have driven this.
Yeah, I mean, this is our experience, I'm afraid, that organisations... there are, you know, lots of miscarriage organizations, lots of organizations that support victims and survivors, people like Charlotte and others who are investigating or, you know, off their own back, so to speak, take responsibility rather than those who should be taking responsibility. I thought we had a structure. We have structures in place. We have, you know, institutions in place who should be doing their job, and they failed in this case. As I said a few minutes ago, to me, the most worrying thing, or as worrying thing as anything else, of course, the most worrying thing is the loss of life. But as worrying is that life could have been prevented. Loss of life could have been prevented if people had done their job. And of course, then the question presents itself, has it happened again? Has it happened since? Did it happen before? Will it happen again in the future? And I don't see any assurance, and Charlotte, I don't suppose you do, that that is, you know, that's been dealt with. That particular issue has been addressed, particularly if people are still arguing about who was responsible.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, interestingly, when I was at the inquest, there was a student journalist there, and he was particularly interested in the Port case, trying to sort of get up to speed, but he was investigating a current murder of a young gay man that was in suspicious circumstances as well. So I suppose time will only tell, but it's... it can be very brutal, the impact. I mean, obviously, with this one, you so clearly see that the police's failure to try and link these cases resulted in appalling consequences for the victims.
Devastating.
Absolutely appalling.
Do you think Port could be responsible for other murders that haven't been dealt with, either treated as
certainly
murders
rapes?
Or him,
I have no doubt that he will have been responsible for other rapes. I mean, if Reynald Singer is you know, a good judge, you know, we're talking about hundreds of rapes in his case. Most of the victims, particularly if they've been drugged, wouldn't know that they've been raped even, you know. Mm-hmm. So I have no doubt that Port's responsible for more rapes. Murders, I don't know the answer to that question.
Yeah. I mean, I completely agree with you, Nazir, on that. It was so unnerving to read a little bit of the information about some of the men that were brave enough to come forward about the sexual assaults there. And obviously there's complications that you're dealing with in terms of this, you know, and you have to worry about how gay men in the future would feel about coming forward to the police on this basis. You know, it certainly would scare me if I was in the situation where I was feeling I'm gay and I want to try and get the police involved. And so I want to try and explain to them, you know, that they made the ultimate sacrifice of coming forward because I think they felt like something had to happen here. But yes, you have to wonder, don't you, whether there are other victims out there that just decided they
can't
come forward.
And that's one of the massive problems here. You've got elements of society who are more vulnerable than others. And we've talked about this many times, Nazir, when it's about if policing changed to police the most vulnerable, you could reduce some of those elements of murders and crimes that happen to the most vulnerable.
Specialist teams, specialist experts, they ought to have, specialist officers that deal with it, that engage with the LGBT community, with the Black community, with the Gypsy and Traveller community, with, all the issues that we're familiar with in the past, all of that's sadly gone because resources meant that they closed down the units, they got rid of specialisms, they brought in individuals who don't have the experience that previous groups had, and of course the engagement with the communities
if you don't engage with a community that's already identified as being vulnerable, you end up isolating them even more. Yeah. And you know, how many people will see this story, read this story? The Metropolitan Police haven't accepted responsibility. They haven't accepted those failings. How can you, as a member of the LGBT plus community, have confidence that when I go to the police, they are going to treat it seriously, they are going to listen to it, rather than simply put them into a corner and stereotype them and say, well, perhaps you're less worthy than others? And I genuinely believe that we are decades on from the 70s and 80s and the misogyny that sits there. But at certain elements of society, those people who are most vulnerable remain exactly that.
I suppose, I wonder, you know, I did, as I say, speak to one of the partner of the third victim who felt he was very badly treated by the police. He was had been together with Daniel for a number of years, but yet was excluded from going to the murder scene, et cetera, et cetera. And I think there was some sort of apology from a senior police officer, but I think the response from victims' families are, I want to see that in action. I don't trust you. You said you're going to examine the police's actions. That hasn't kind of come through. At the inquest, I'm not quite sure specifically what the reasons were, but the inquest jury were not allowed to consider, had homophobia played a part in this?
They weren't allowed to consider that.
No,
the coroner didn't want them to answer that question.
That's shocking.
Sometimes you don't want to answer the question because you don't like the answer you're going to get. I wonder if that played a part. The reality, of course, is that people know. People know from their own experience how they feel about the way they're being policed or not, as the case may be. So we're just, you know, people can't remain in denial about this. This is a big issue that will sadly recur. And, you know, I'm really grateful to you, Charlotte, for bringing it to our attention and for sharing your extraordinary knowledge on this. And I hope at some point we can get some closure, that people will be held accountable for what didn't do, more importantly. And of course, going forward, that people can feel safe. To answer your question, Mark, about whether people have confidence, the reality is that all we have is the police. And so if you're a victim of LGBT violence or homophobic crime, please come forward. And you know, that's all I can ask.
And I think, you know, Charlotte, we've been very critical of the police, and rightly so. And obviously that police officer that saw the CCTV and recognised Port did a good job. Is there any other elements of the policing investigation that actually they did do a good job in?
I don't want to be completely biased there. I was taken by the sort of quite impassioned plea that the person who was in charge of the case or overseeing the case at a DI level, he basically said, you know, we weren't being lazy, we were trying. But I can't help but kind of feel that falls a bit on deaf ears. I think the issue about the primacy was obviously one to contend with, you know, and it puts in a larger kind of relief, maybe the whole issue about funding and how overstretched the police are. I didn't necessarily hear all the evidence on that, but I do think that that's difficult. I would say, and I think generally kind of an awful lot of the victims that I had spoken with, or the victims' families, I'm sorry, would say that the family liaison just did a really appalling job at trying to kind of keep them informed about what was actually happening. Mm-hmm. And I mean, almost to a person, each family member waged a battle to try and get the police to listen to them. Mm-hmm. A senior officer from the Metropolitan Police was called to give evidence at the inquest and apologised to the families. He said that many things weren't done that should have been. The family solicitor said that it was one of the most widespread institutional failures in modern history, and that four white heterosexual girls would have been treated differently.
Sad, really. I mean, Nazir, I think we all echo the views that those members of society, the LGBT plus communities in particular, because that's what we're talking about today, you know, I'd urge them, you know, where, please do come forward. There are some brilliant police officers out there. There are some amazing social workers, probation officers, you know, members of society who are there and will help you and will get it right. You know, sadly, in this case, the families have been horrifically let down, but there are some brilliant officers out there. So, you know, please, please do still have faith. We have to have faith. As you say, Nazir, they're the only organisation that can help us.
That's all we have.
Charlotte, it's a brilliant. And thank you so much. So what's next for you after this?
Onward and upward to the next thing. Watch this space. I am definitely wanting to kind of keep following on from this one, just from the point of view of thinking, well, the Met have made various promises and what will happen from there. I suppose it's a case of just sort of trying to think a little bit of holding the police to account. I mean, you're obviously aware of the terrible case of the two sisters that were murdered and then the officers that were brought up on gross misconduct charges. I mean, I suppose the query for me is what constitutes gross misconduct. If you know if your failings mean that someone ends up dead and then another person and then another person, what does it take? But as you say, I think it's very right that we've got to be optimistic. There were certainly improvements that were outlined by the police in terms of their computerized systems and forcing actions, etc., etc. But I suppose it is a worry in terms of the funding and the training of police officers that does have to improve.
Brilliant. Charlotte, listen, thank you so much for coming and joining us. And Nazir, and another amazing chat. I mean, it's one of those cases that until you really start to listen to the detail and unpick it, we only hear the surface of it, don't we, really?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, there has been that drama that Charlotte mentioned, which is well-regarded and well-reviewed and everything. But generally, the way people are in this world, I'm afraid, is today's news is tomorrow's chip paper. You know, they moved on from Stephen Port and what he did and the victims that he left behind. And they're thinking about today's terrible atrocities. So we've got to keep it in the eye. We've got to keep an eye on it to make sure that people responded appropriately. And ultimately, people have changed the way that they behave and what they will do differently. So, you know, I'm really glad to you, Charlotte, for bringing it to our attention. I hope that there'll be others who bring other similar cases to our attention and we can see whether or not progress is being made or what needs to be done.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to join you. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you. Well, it's been great talking to you, Charlotte. Thank you so much for coming on Fear or Favour. And Nazir, as always, you're a star. Busy week ahead.
When is it not?
One of these days, you're going to say to me, do you know what? I'm off to Mauritius tomorrow.
No, not going to happen. Anytime soon, I'm afraid.
Anyway, brilliant. Nazir, look after yourself. Have a fantastic week. Thank you very much for listening to Fear or Favour. Do send us an email. You can contact us via our Twitter page or by the website. Thank you very much for listening. Join us next week for another case of Fear or Favour. Thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this week's podcast. Do please tell your true crime friends, and it's important that you subscribe to our channel. If you've got any thoughts or you just simply want to get in touch, you can do so via our Twitter page, Fear or Favour, or go to our website, www.fearorfavour.com. The series is edited by Martin Kayes, the music by Dylan Epega. Fear or Favour is an original true crime podcast in association with Audioboom.